Turn with me, if you will, to Exodus, or the book of Shemot, chapter 6. We actually finished just a couple of verses into this one. I'll probably start out and at least back up a verse or two to make it clear while we take a run at this one. Chapter 6 begins by the words that Ve'yamar Yahuwah al Moshe. And Yahuwah said to Moshe, "Now you will see what I will do to Pharaoh, because by a strong hand he's going to let my people go. He will drive them out of his land." And then we have these words, and this is part of the reason why I want to do this, because I think this is essentially the real theme of the book of the Exodus. Yahuwah spoke to Moshe, and he said unto him, "Ani Yahuwah, Ani Yahuwah." And I mentioned this last week because we're going to see that show up throughout here. I saw a another reminder on this one, the Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. And we remember that, you know, the discussion last time had to do with, by this name, I was not necessarily known to the patriarchs. But essentially, that name, the Tetragrammaton, has been said by some of the sages to be an amalgam of three words, and I am that I am, I was, I am, and I will be. All of that we know, but it's interesting, of course, to remember, if you look at it, Yod, and then the He, and then the Vav, and the He, you got essentially three words that are kind of amalgamated in there. One is Hayah, then Hove, or Hoye, and then Aye. Hayah, Hoye, Aye. And it is literally the word for was, is, and will be. And we're going to see that theme again. I am that I am who I am. And everybody is going to know it. And that really is the point of the story. It's the thing that's kind of the hardest for people to wrap their heads around. I saw an interesting presentation. They do some cute things up on Rabbi David Foreman's site. He's got a couple of folks that are new, that are, well, they're new to us anyway, that are helping him out with the videos and doing the recordings and so forth. And they were essentially drawing the connection between this portion and the importance of literally Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh calling his shot, saying, "Here is what I am. And here is how you're going to know what I am, because I'm going to show you, I'm going to tell you, I'm going to do what I'm going to do, and then I'm going to do it. And then, of course, when it's all done, I'm going to tell them what I told them and tell them what I did," right? I was, I am, and I will be. And the connection that they made was, hey, you know, everybody always, they wonder, what's the point of the Creator having to bring His people out of bondage by a mighty hand? Right? He could have just literally levitated them or beamed them up, Scotty, to wherever they needed to go. Why not simply do that? And that's the point of the book, because that doesn't give us the message that we get this way. And their connection was this idea of Babe Ruth, one of the most famous points in baseball history, where the, without going through all the details, basically tight ball game, World Series, Babe Ruth is at the plate. He's got two strikes on him, and most people probably remember this. He points to the outfield fence and then proceeds very next pitch to hit it right smack over the place where he just pointed to. So he called his shot. Now, that's not what's memorable. Calling the shot's easy. It's doing it that's the hard part. And that's, of course, exactly the connection with this Torah portion. So let's go through these first few verses, because verse 3 is really where it begins. And it says this, "Vayera, and I appeared." Vayera all of these folks. I appeared to Abraham, unto Isaac, unto Yaakov, as El Shaddai. But by my name, Yahuwah, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, I was not, or I did not choose to make myself known to them, at least not yet. And, he says, though, I did establish my covenant with them to give them this land, the land of Canaan, the land of their sojournings, where they did sojourn. And moreover, he reminds us again, now I've heard the groaning of the children of Israel, whom the Egyptians, the Mitzrayites, keep in bondage, and I have remembered, I have literally zakar, I have called to mind my covenant. Now, that brings us to verse 6, which is considered to be probably one of the most important elements of this. Certainly, if you look at the traditional Haggadah, the Passover Seder, when these things are remembered, the four so-called I ams or I wills that are in here. So therefore, says Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh to Moshe, tell the children of Israel, I am Yahuwah, Ani Yahuwah, again, and, here we go, I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians, and I will deliver you from their bondage, and I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with great judgments, and I will take you. Lechach. I like that word. It's the same word, of course, that's used when a man takes a wife in a metaphorical sense and literally in a physical sense. I will take you to me, he says, as a people, and I will be to you an Elohim, and you shall know that Ani Yahuwah Elohekim, I am Yahuwah your El, who brought you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. And finally, I will bring you into the land which he's promised, concerning which I lifted up my hand to give it to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Yaakov, and it will be to you. I will give it to you for a heritage. And then we hear it again. Ani Yahuwah. So, Moshe tells exactly that to the children of Israel, but they didn't listen. They did not hearken. They did not shamar him. Because, and this is where Scripture actually tells us why. They didn't listen because of impatience of spirit and for this cruel bondage. Now, I'm thinking that this might be a theme I'll talk a little bit more about tomorrow when we go into a little bit more depth on some of the specifics. Obviously, on Erev Shabbat, one of the things I try to do is talk about the whole portion, and there is a whole lot of meat in here, so just getting through it is a good challenge. But this verse, 6-9, is one that is also kind of focused on by the sages. Why didn't they listen? Well, it tells us, and it would seem like this is a minor point, but in reality, it's a bigger issue than we might want to pause and, well, not pause, I guess, and overlook. And I'm going to suggest that this is particularly true now, too. I'm looking at some comments from Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks. Again, I'll probably go into some more detail on this tomorrow, but he says, remember, when Moshe first met God at the burning bush, and he told him, you're going to lead, Moses kept saying, no, I can't do that, right? I'm a man of uncircumcised lips, slow of speech and tongue. They won't listen to me anyway. I lacked eloquence is one of the excuses he made, basically. Not an inspirational leader is how this fellow summarizes it. Ultimately, I'm going to suggest to you something that is probably a negative. Moshe, remember, is considered to be one of the greatest prophets of all time. And here you go. What was he doing? He was allowing his lips to speak something that was pretty negative. He was prophesying. He was prophesying negatively over himself. I think there's a moral in there. And what Rabbi Sacks says is it turns out Moshe was both right and wrong. They didn't listen to him. And I'm going to suggest he was partly right about the cause, too, because he was, in fact, prophesying negatively about himself. He had to be educated on that score. But Scripture does say there were these other mitigating factors. Their spirit was broken. The labor was harsh. And ultimately, the sages say, look, if people are starving, if they are burdened in a physical sense, it's tough to get them to focus on the spiritual stuff. And I think that is a really key point. It's important for us to remember that kind of thing today as we see a nation literally heading into the kind of hard bondage that most Americans are ill-prepared for, don't have a clue what's coming. If you want to improve people's spiritual situation, you have to improve their physical situation, is the normal way that this is phrased. I'm going to suggest that the converse is also true and disgusting, and we're seeing it play out. If you want to destroy people's spiritual situation, first, make them physically miserable. And I guess we will see all of that. That is, in fact, again, part of the reason why, as we talk about this book of the Exodus, and we go through some of the things that are parallels here, and we look at this concept of the bookends. If there is an Exodus in the beginning of the book, and the end of the book hasn't yet been written, but there's a greater Exodus that's prophesied, well, what might some of the characteristics of that be? What do we have to look forward to? What do we have to be concerned about? What cautions and precautions can we take? So here we go. Let's talk about some of those things. Yahuwah spoke to Moshe, saying, "Go and speak to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, that he let the children of Israel go out of his land." Well, Moshe says again, "Behold, they haven't listened to me yet. Why? And how do you expect that Pharaoh is going to hear me? Because I am of uncircumcised lips." So he spoke to Moshe and to Aaron, gave him a charge. And he said some things that we're going to get to in a minute. But then, where does this come from? Kind of comes out of left field, it would seem. Verse 14 all of a sudden switches gears and says, "Well, here are the heads of the father's houses." Tells us who the sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, are. Hanok, Palu, Hezron, Carmi. These are the families of Reuben. Then it tells us about Simeon and his brothers by two different mothers, evidently. These are their families. Then we talk about Levi, all of their generations, Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. And at this point, it starts telling us how old these folks were and goes through the grandchildren, too. Then it tells us a little bit about Aaron, who has a wife named Elisheba, daughter of Aminadab, sister of Nachshon. And she bore him some sons that we're going to see later on in this book and elsewhere in Scripture. Nadab, Abihu, then Eleazar, and Ithamar. Sons of Korah are described, and so forth and so on. I'm not going to go through all of those, but I am going to mention verse 26. Because after this long description, it says, "These are those that Aaron and Moshe, to whom Yahuwah said, 'Bring out the children of Israel from the land of Mitzrayim,'" okay, "according to their hosts." So here's what you're going to say, but first, this message from our sponsor: here are the hosts, the heads of their father's house, bring them out according to those hosts. These are the ones, it says, that spoke to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to bring those children of Israel out. These are they that Moshe and Aaron basically led. So, comes to pass on the day that Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh spoke to Moshe there, and he said to him, "Ani Yahuwah." We're going to get used to that. We're going to hear that a lot. "Speak unto Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and tell him everything that I tell you to tell him." Well, Moshe says it again. I got these uncircumcised lips. How is it that Pharaoh is going to hearken to me? Look, I have literally made you as a master, as a mighty one, an Elohim. I've set you in God's stead, is how this English renders it, as far as Pharaoh is concerned. And Aaron, your brother, he's going to be your spokesman, your prophet. So speak all that I command you. Aaron, your brother, will be the one that relays that to Pharaoh, and he shall let the children of Israel go. Oh, and by the way, I guess I ought to tell you, I'm going to harden Pharaoh's heart and multiply my signs and my wonders in the land of Mitzrayim. Now, here is another one of those places. This is another one of those themes that shows up throughout this section. I've emphasized it a lot in years past. I'm certainly not going to overlook it this time, but I'm probably not going to spend quite as much time on it, other than to make some comments that I always try to note. What does it mean that he's going to harden Pharaoh's heart? Doesn't Pharaoh have free will? Does he have a choice? And the answer is very much like what we see in America today, and people need to be aware of. Yeah, we have free will. But you know what? Sometimes you make your bed, you're going to lie in it. Sometimes once you make a life-altering mistake, you're going to have to follow it through. So Pharaoh has a choice. But once Pharaoh makes the choice, Katie, bar the door. Buckle up and be ready for the ride. You may not like where it takes you. And furthermore, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh already knows this. He says, Pharaoh ain't going to listen. He is not going to shamar, hearken unto you. And I'm going to lay my hand upon Egypt. I will bring forth my hosts, my people, B'nai Israel, the children of Israel, out of the land by great judgments. And the Egyptians, too, they will know. What are they going to know? Same thing we know now, Ani Yahuwah, when I stretch forth my hand on Egypt, and I bring out the children of Israel from among them. Well, so Moshe and Aaron did what they were commanded. As they were commanded, it says, so they did. There's another one of these key, oft-repeated, and important sentences. They were issued some commands. That's what they did. And then it tells us, this has always been one of those other things that I find comforting, because most of us aren't yet 80 years old. Moshe was 80. He was 80. And Aaron was even a bit older. He was 3 years older when they spoke to Pharaoh. So we're literally seeing, again, this theme that I think is so fascinating. You can divide Moses' life up into three segments. First 40 years, growing up in Egypt, learning the law, learning the custom, learning about their gods, learning about his heritage. And then he spends 40 years out in the boondocks in the wilderness learning how to tend sheep. Sounds like you could just pretty well skip that phase, right? But obviously, it's really, really important to what follows. And here we are entering into the last phase, the phase that gets the most ink in Torah, the Exodus itself, where Moshe is going to lead the people of Israel for 40 years. And he starts at age 80. A lot of life left in the old guy. Then Yahuwah spoke to Moshe and unto Aaron, saying, when Pharaoh speaks to you and says, hey, show me something really impressive. Show me a wonder. Well, here's what you're going to do. Aaron, take your rod, cast it down before Pharaoh, and it will become a serpent. And I'm going to double check here. I thought maybe that word would be nakash, but I don't see it in there. Should be. Anyway, Moshe and Aaron went. They did what they were commanded. Aaron cast down his rod, and you know what happens. It became a serpent. But, hey, you can almost hear him saying, well, that's not such a big deal. We can do that. So Pharaoh called for his sorcerers, his magicians, and they did the same thing with their secret arts. All of them cast down their rods. And look at that. We, too, can turn them into serpents. But, got a problem. Aaron's rod swallowed up their rods. And, Pharaoh's heart, says verse 13, here's this theme again, was hardened. He didn't hearken to them, just as Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh had correctly foreseen. The word here in verse 13, for Pharaoh's heart was hardened, you may recognize it, it's ve-yach-zach. And it's the same root, if you've ever heard the expression, I love it, be strong and of good courage, kazach. It's the same root there. It's a chet and a zadik, a kof. Same root as be strong. So you could almost think of this as Pharaoh's heart was strong. Yeah, muy fuerte, they would say in Espanol. But he didn't listen. And then Yahuwah said something slightly different. He says to Moshe, Pharaoh's heart is stubborn. And that word in the Hebrew is kabed. It's also hardened, but stubborn probably shows you the difference between these two words. Pharaoh can make his heart strong, he can make his heart stubborn, but there's going to come a time where his heart just basically is both strong and stubborn, and he ain't going to be able to change it anymore. So, Yahuwah says to Moshe, at this point, he uses a different word to describe Pharaoh's lev. It is kabed. So get into Pharaoh in the morning. Look, that's when he goes out to the water. Stand by the river Nile, meet him, and that rod, which was turned into a serpent, you take it in your hand and say to him the following things. Yahuwah, Elohim of the Hebrews, has sent me to you, saying, let my people go, so they can serve me in the wilderness, and you have not shamarred, buddy. So, thus says Yahuwah, here is how you will know, Ani Yahuwah. Behold, I'm going to smite my rod in my hand upon the waters in the river. They will be turned into dam. Dam, blood. Fish that's in the river, they're all going to die. River's going to stink, and the Egyptians aren't going to want to drink out of this thing. So, Yahuwah said to Moshe, speak to Aaron. Tell him, take his rod, stretch it out over the waters, over the rivers, streams, pools, ponds, and they will become blood. There will be blood throughout the land of Egypt in all the vessels of wood and of stone too. So Moshe and Aaron did what they were commanded to do. They lifted up the rod, and of course the waters were turned to blood. The fish died, everything exactly as was foretold. Well, here come the magicians of Mitzrayim. Look at that. Can they do the same thing, at least as far as appearances seem to be? They did it. Pharaoh's heart was still kazak. He didn't hearken to them, all of which was as had been said. He turned and went home. And he didn't particularly dwell on the matter, is basically how this boils down. The Egyptians started looking for water. They couldn't find any. Took 7 days after this whole thing had taken place before Yahuwah spoke to Moshe and said, all right, go see Pharaoh. Say to him, let my people go. Thus says Yahuwah, so they may serve me. If you refuse to let them go, we're just now getting rolling. Next, I will smite all your borders, your whole land, with Zephardim, with frogs. Plague number two. By the way, this Torah portion, we're going to see the first 7 of the 10 plagues. The plagues are really laid out in a fascinating fashion. One of the things that I think is important to point out too as we go through here, Ani Yahuwah, the overriding theme, Pharaoh's hard heart. The magicians that think they can do all of the stuff that this God of the Hebrews can do. Who is this Yahuwah? We remember having heard famous last words, I know him not. Well, you will. And now we're seeing the plagues. What is it about the plagues? Well, they're literally divided into 3 groups of 3 plus 1. Kind of fascinating. As I go through some of these this evening, we'll talk about elements of this. Literally, you could spend not just hours, but days dividing these things up, seeing the comparisons, looking at the Hebrew words. It's an incredible, a fascinating study. And suffice it to say for now that the way I like to describe it in a nutshell is what the creator of the universe is doing as he goes through and says, Ani Yahuwah, is holding up all of these things that to our minds might seem, well, irritations or trivial when there's just a few of them, but when there become, you know, billions of them, like with frogs or lice, now they get to be a real problem. But moreover, so far as the Egyptians were concerned, all of these things, including, by the way, let's not forget, Pharaoh, were Elohim, mighty ones. They were gods. Now, what I find is fascinating, of course, if you look at the Egyptian so-called gods, the mighty ones, the things that they worshipped and thought were really important and set aside, you'd say, well, you know, America, the greater Babylon metro area today, we don't worship frogs or lice or any of those kind of things. We got different gods. So it's kind of fascinating. I can't help but, as I go through this, wonder when this same set of bookends repeats, how will it look? We're going to see blood, probably, frogs and lice and swarms of flies and various kinds of things, blisters, boils, pox, cattle sickness. Well, you know what? Wouldn't surprise me if, in fact, one way or the other, if you look at the Hebrew root words, we see literally maybe in an inverse order, a line for line repeat of these same things. But it might also be that in a modern context, some of those gods will be a little bit different. How it's going to play out, I think we have a picture here. But as far as the specifics are concerned, you know, are the modern frogs going to look like the Egyptian frogs? Don't know. How about the pox that we're getting ready to talk about? Plague number 6. Well, those might in fact be fairly similar, but I'm guessing some of them might be genetically engineered. Who knows? The point is, it's funny and fun and interesting to go through these things and focus on at least a few as we're talking about them in this overview of the main elements. All right, that takes us back to verse 28. The frogs. River's going to swarm with these frogs. They're going to go everywhere. Into your bedroom, up on your bed, into the house of your servants. They're going to be in your ovens, in your kneading troughs. That's a nasty picture. Frogs everywhere. You got something to eat, frogs in it. You got something to sleep on, frogs there. How about on the couch? You name it, we got frogs. They're going to be on you, upon your people, and upon all your servants. As I'm thinking about that, you know what? I wouldn't be surprised we don't see some genetically modified frankenfrogs in the Exodus to come. We'll just have to wait and see. Anyway, Yahuwah says unto Moshe, now this is chapter 8, say to Aaron, stretch forth your hand out over the rivers, canals, pools, and give them frogs, man. Here they come. So Aaron did so. He stretched out his hand. Here come the frogs. They cover the land of Egypt. Now, this part is almost funny. I'm tempted to do the stand-up when I read this. You've probably heard the song. Maybe we'll pull it up and play it tomorrow. One More Night with the Frogs. There is no shortage of humor as well as one-upmanship. And that's what's really interesting about this part of the portion. You know the Creator has a sense of humor, of irony, and all of that is playing out. And you sometimes miss it. So I will go through a bit of it. Here you have the magicians. Can we make frogs? You betcha, we can make frogs. As if they didn't already have enough frogs. Right? We got frogs coming everywhere. What do you need the magicians to do? Yeah, let's make some more. That'll show it. Good grief. So they did their secret arts. They too can bring more frogs. Just exactly what everybody wants. Pharaoh then calls for Moshe and he says, talk to Yahuwah and, let him take away the frogs from me and from my people, and I will let the people go. They can go out and do their sacrifices to Yahuwah. Moshe says to Pharaoh, have you this glory over me? What time, O Pharaoh, what time would you like the frogs to disappear for your servants and for your people, that the frogs would be destroyed from your house and from all of the river? And, everywhere except the river. We'll leave some in the river only. In other words, I'm going to give you a chance. Name that time. Now, Rashi points out that literally the key here is the use of the word the lamed in here. What time is it that you'd like the frogs to be destroyed? And here comes the one-upmanship and the interesting interplay, the chess, if you will. Pharaoh is probably thinking that, the frogs are getting ready to disappear. They're going to be gone, probably right now. I'm clever by half. So, I'm not going to tell him what he would expect me to tell him, which is, immediately I'd like the frogs gone right away. No! I'm going to tell him tomorrow! Yeah, and here comes the line, right? One more night with the frogs. Pharaoh just loves with the frogs. Let's just have one more night with the frogs. So he does. He says, I want them tomorrow. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Well, says Moshe, be it according to your word, so that you can know that there is no one like Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. Frogs will depart from you, your houses, servants' houses, all the people. They'll remain only in the river as of tomorrow. So Moshe went out. He talked to Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh concerning the frogs, and Yahuwah did according to the word of Moshe. The frogs died out of the houses, courts, fields, and they gathered them together in heaps, and they stank. Imagine billions and billions of frogs rotting in the sun. But Pharaoh, not so true to his word, saw that the frogs were gone, and he made kabed. He hardened, he stiffened his own heart. And he did not do what he had said he would do. He didn't hearken. So Yahuwah says to Moshe, say to Aaron, stretch out your rod. We're going to go for number three now. Smite the dust of the earth that it can become gnats, or some translations say lice here. Kinim, kin, plural, really, really plural, lots and lots of them, kinim, lice or gnats, throughout all the land of Egypt. Little teeny bugs in south of the border, they call them noceums. Little tiny things, but lots and lots of them. Well, anyway, they did that. Aaron stretched out his hand with the rod and smote the dust of the earth, and there were gnats, lice everywhere. Man and beast, all the dust of the earth became gnats throughout all of Mitzrayim. One more time. Gonna bring in the magicians, and they too, see if they can create some gnats. Now, here, there's a question on the screen. I know we're several minutes behind. How were these folks able to differentiate between the frogs that were sent by Yah and the ones that the magicians sent? You know what? I can't say that I've ever given that a lot of thought, nor is it probably too big of a concern for the average person on the street, where the frogs, are coming from. Just the fact that they got so stinking many of them. My guess is that the frogs the magician made, were probably localized. You know, maybe they stuck around Pharaoh's house, but there were plenty of frogs regardless. So this time, we got the magicians coming in. Let's see. We don't have enough lice, not enough gnats. We will make some more. Magicians did so. They tried their best to bring forth gnats. Guess what? No can do. They couldn't make any more gnats. No more lice. They failed. So here is the first of the cases of the plagues, where up until this point, with first the serpents made out of rods, and then, of course, making blood from water, and the frogs, the magicians are able to say, look, we can do anything you can do, I can do also. But here they couldn't. They failed. And at this point, we see an admission in verse 15. Magicians said to Pharaoh, uh-oh, this is the finger of Elohim. But Pharaoh's heart was strong. It was kazak. And he didn't hearken, just exactly as Yahuwah had spoken. So at this point, Yahuwah talks to Moshe. He says, get up early in the morning, stand before Pharaoh when he comes out to the water and say to him, thus says Yahuwah, let my people go that they may serve me. And if you ain't going to listen still, behold, next, I will send swarms of flies upon you. Various insects. Arov here is the word. And there is some scholarly disputation about what exactly these little swarming insects are. Presumably they're bigger than the lice or gnats that we had before. Maybe even more irritating. But swarms of flies probably at least gets it. By the time you got billions and billions of these things hanging around, maybe the insectologist, what's the word I'm looking for? Anyway, I doubt that there's a whole lot of interest in trying to figure out specifically what they were. They're a nuisance. They're going to be in your houses, and the Egyptians' homes will be full of swarms of flies. They'll be on the ground, and wherever they are, there'll be flies. Now, at this point, we see another thing that happens. You can kind of draw a line if you've got a chart of these various plagues. Draw a line here and say, okay, Now something very important happens. Verse 18 says, I will set apart in that day the land of Goshen, where my people are. Ain't going to be no swarms of flies up there. To the end that now you will know. Ani Yahuwah in the midst of the earth. I'm going to set apart or sever. And that root word there is palah. It has a lot of interesting connotations in the Hebrew, but essentially make a separation is the key. And we're going to see that separation now holds from this point forward. Verse 19 says, I will put a division, padut, between my people and your people, he says to Pharaoh. By tomorrow, right? We're going to rub this in a bit. Yeah, you want to know when this is going to happen? Oh, yeah, tomorrow. By tomorrow, this sign shall be. Yahuwah did so. Here come grievous swarms of flies into the house of Pharaoh, servants' houses. They're all over the place. Literally, the land was ruined by the swarms of flies. And Pharaoh calls to Moshe and Aaron. He says, all right, go on out, sacrifice to your Elohim in the land. Moses says, nope, that's not a good idea. We sacrifice the abomination of the Egyptians to Yahuwah our Elohim. If we sacrifice the abomination of the Egyptians before their eyes, won't they stone us? In other words, this is just not a practical solution. Instead, he says, we'll go 3 days' journey into the wilderness and sacrifice to Yahuwah Eloheka, and he will do this, we'll do this because this is what he has commanded us to do. So we will do, in other words, as he commands. Well, says Pharaoh, I'll let you go. So you can sacrifice to Yahuwah in the wilderness. Just don't go too far, all right? Ask him about that. Well, I'll go out from you, says Moshe. I will entreat Yahuwah that these swarms of flies can depart from all of you folks tomorrow. Remember, you asked for it. You got it. Only don't let Pharaoh deal deceitfully. Don't lie to us anymore in telling us you're going to do something and then not doing it. So Moshe went out. He talked to Yahuwah, and what happened was according to Moshe's word. The swarms of flies were removed, and there remained not one of them. Take a guess what happened, as if we didn't already know the story. Pharaoh hardened his own heart. He made it stubborn again. He didn't let the people go. And this takes us to chapter 9, where we're starting to wrap up this week's Parsha with the last few of the plagues here, at least the last few we're going to talk about this time. Yahuwah then says to Moshe, go into Pharaoh, tell him the following. Thus says Yahuwah, Elohim of the Hebrews, let my people go so they can serve me. And if you refuse still to let them go, here's what's going to happen next. The hand of Yahuwah is going to be upon the cattle in your fields, upon the horses, the asses, the camels, the herds, flocks, everything you can imagine. There's going to be a really serious bunch of, well, nasty that will come down upon all your cattle. And, just as you've seen before, so that you know exactly what we're talking about here, Yahuwah is going to make a division, a separation between the cattle of the people, the B'nai Israel, and the cattle of Mitzrayim, of Egypt. Ain't going to be nothing that dies that belongs to the children of Israel. Oh, and guess when we're going to do this, right? You've said it. You got it. Tomorrow, Yahuwah is going to do this thing in the land. And he did it on the morrow. All the cattle of Egypt died, but of the cattle of the children of Israel, not one. Now, I'm going to pause for a second. Right? If this is a natural event, you could hear this. You could hear this in CNN playing out on the news nowadays. Yes, there is a tremendous plague of cattle or of bird flu or of whatever it would be, and scientists are at a loss to explain why bloody, bloody, blah, right? I have a suspicion, in other words, that there were a lot of people that if they had the kind of press that we have today, that wouldn't be getting the straight story. Oh yeah, cattle dying all over the place. How many people can go up to the land of Goshen and see? But I suspect, nevertheless, and we certainly know that the truth has a way of coming out. Well, Pharaoh sent his own folks. Behold, let's check it out. Not so much as one cattle of the Israelites died. But he was still kabod. His heart was stubborn. He wasn't going to let anybody go. So now Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh says to Moshe and Aaron, take handfuls of soot from the furnace, throw it heavenwards so that Pharaoh can see it. And it's going to become small dust and spread all over the land of Egypt. And it's going to be a boil breaking forth with blains upon man and upon beasts throughout all the land of Mitzrayim. This one is Shekhin in the Hebrew. Boils, blisters, pox. Pox might be a similar word. They did what they were told. They took some soot, they threw it in heavenward before the eyes of Pharaoh, and it became a boil on man and beast. The magicians, poor magicians, they are finally starting to get it, I think. They couldn't even stand before Moshe because of all the boils. They were upon the magicians and upon, in fact, all of the Egyptians. Now, what is fascinating is to see how all of this plays into the picture that the Creator is so incredibly skillfully weaving as this process plays out. First, the magicians are able to do it, to repeat the miracle or the plague, and then they're not. And then, once it's been shown that they can't anymore duplicate the feat, now we're going to make a separation. Not only can you guys not do it, you can't explain how come it is that it's just on the people who are being plagued and not upon the people that I am trying to get free here. And here now you got these poor magicians standing before Pharaoh. And they can't even stand. The boils are upon them. And now, for the first time, we're going to see several things happen. Verse 12, chapter 9, says, and it's Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh at this point who hardened, who strengthened, who literally gave fortitude to Pharaoh to pursue the self-destructive course that he is darned sure he has decided to pursue. He might have been tempted to fail, to chicken out, to cave, but he's made his bed. He's going to lie in it, boils and all. And it's Yahuwah for the first time that is, in fact, strengthening, making chazak his heart. In for a penny, in for a pound. So he didn't listen, just as had been expected. And now this time, Yahuwah says to Moses, get up early in the morning, stand before Pharaoh, and say the following. Right? We've heard it before. Thus says Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, Elohim of the Hebrews, let my people go that they can serve me. For this time, I'm going to send all my plagues upon your, literally the word here is, hearts. Your lev, your person is how it's rendered, but it's really on your heart. And upon your servants and upon your people that you may know, that you may know intimately, yada, there is no one like me on all the earth. Hey, you're the one thinks you're a god? Yeah. You'll see. Surely now had I put forth my hand and smitten you and your people with pestilence, you'd been cut off from the earth. But in this very deed for cause, I have made you stand. I am showing you my power. I'm giving you a chance to see the truth here. That my name, says Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, may be declared throughout all Ha'aretz, the earth. And yet you exalt yourself against my people. You ain't going to let them go. We'll see. Behold, tomorrow, about this same time, it's going to rain. And this time it's going to be a very grievous hail. Big stuff. You ain't ever seen anything the like of it. Such has not been seen in Mitzrayim, not since the day it was founded, even until now. So here, listen up, you folks that are paying attention. Get your cattle and everything you have in out of the fields. For every man and beast that is out from under cover when this thing cuts loose is not going to get brought home again. They'll get hailed on and they will die. So verse 20 is the place where we see all of this stuff with the magicians and with the people who are paying attention coming to a fruition. Verse 20 tells us that those who feared Yirah, the word of Yahuwah, among the servants of Pharaoh even. These are folks in Pharaoh's own house. People who have figured it out. They're seeing this play out day to day, and they know what's going on. They, in fact, those that feared the word of Yahuwah, and that knew that what Moshe had told them was going to happen, was fixing to happen, brought their cattle into the house. Anybody that didn't listen, left their cattle in the field, well, you know what happened to them. So, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh says to Moshe, stretch out your hand. There is hail coming, man, beast, on every herb of the field throughout the land of Mitzrayim. Moses did as he was told, stretched out his rod, and we got thunder and hail and fire, all of which ran down on the earth. And Yahuwah caused hail to fall upon the entire land of Mitzrayim. And there was hail and fire amidst the hail. Grievous stuff, such as had not been seen in all the land of Egypt since it became a nation. Now, there's an interesting observation to be made here, too. And this is one that I think probably registered with the Egyptians, the people of Mitzrayim that were paying attention. Because remember, we've already said that all of these various things were considered to be mighty ones, godlike. And you can look at the Greeks and Romans and all kinds of others and see this kind of representation of opposites, godlike powers, fire and ice, fire and ice, fire and ice. And if you know one thing about fire and about ice, it's that they're kind of opposites. It's not very often you see fire coexisting with ice. Fire is either melted, the ice is melted by the fire, or if there's enough ice, puts out the fire, but they don't very often hang around together. These are, in other words, opposing gods. And here you got a mightier God than any of them, just basically still rubbing people's nose in it. So, the hail smote all over the place throughout the land of Mitzrayim, man and beast, every herb of the field, and it broke every tree. But only, of course, up north in the land of Goshen, where there were the children of Israel, no hail. So Pharaoh sent, he says, go get me Moshe and Aaron. And he says to them, now listen to this. I have sinned this time. Yahuwah is righteous. And me and my people, we are the wicked ones. So what do we see here? It looks like Pharaoh actually gets it. I've sinned. Yahuwah is righteous. My folks, me and my people, we're the wicked ones. So go to him and ask him and tell him, you know, let's have an end to these mighty thunderings and hail. I'm going to let you go. And you won't have to stay around any longer. Well, says Moshe, soon as I am gone out of the city, I'll spread forth my hands to Yahuwah. Thunders will cease, no more hail, and you may know that the earth belongs to Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. But as for you and your servants, I already get it. I'm gonna tell you something here. I know you will not yet fear Yahuwah Eloheka. Now, the next couple of verses tell us how things were setting up at this point. Flax and the barley, they were smitten. Barley was in the ear, the flax was in bloom. In other words, what survived kind of depended on what stage the crops were in. The wheat and the spelt, they ripen later on, so they managed not to be smitten as much as the flax and the barley. Anyway, Moshe goes out of the city, spreads forth his hands, the thunders, the hail ceased, rain was not poured on the earth. And then what happens? Pharaoh sees, hey, it's all stopped. He decided it was time to go sin some more. He hardened his own heart. He made his own lev, kabed, and he and his servants too. And the heart of Pharaoh was hardened. It was kazakht. And he didn't let the children of Israel go, just as Moshe had already told them was the case, because he had been told that in turn by Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. So here we are. Let's summarize this. That takes us to the end of this portion. I see the questions on the screen about fiery hail, meteor shower. I guess all of those things certainly are possibilities. And in terms of the kind of things that for those of us that look ahead and say, what would it look like in a future time? I find that one certainly believable, at least, that we could have some space debris coming down, and it would certainly be all of the above. You could easily imagine fire mixed with hail in a situation like that. So, in kind of summary, as where we are when we leave this portion, look ahead towards next week, we've now seen plagues 1 through 7, an example of all of these so-called gods of Mitzrayim. One by one, they're being held up and ridiculed. Not only are they being ridiculed, but these gods that the people of Egypt have worshipped, if you will, or at least held in high regard, are turning into kind of a royal pain in the you-know-what, costing them big time. And as we go through this, we see that more and more folks are beginning to see, A, no, men can't do it, and B, there is this separation between the people of Israel and those who are being punished here, plagued, literally. And see, finally, we're starting to listen. When Moshe says, bring your cows inside, you better do it. And other things as well. And that's going to play out, of course, in what lies ahead. Because we know the end of the story, among other things, includes the fact that who finally comes out when this is all said and done is a mixed multitude. There are more than a few people of Mitzrayim, of Egypt, that decide they're going to hang around and go with God, going to go with Moshe when the time comes to leave. So with that, I guess we will pause. Let's see, any questions that I didn't get to? I know that there's a long lag. We'll probably be finished by the time any of them crop up that aren't already there. Okay. All right, don't think so. Oh, got a question? Doesn't the King James state that the Lord hardened his heart? Are we talking about in this place? I don't have I've got a King James light or a King James like sitting in front of me. Which verse are we talking about, Bill? Because eventually he does, and it's already said at least once that was what happened. But at verse 34 here, it says that it's Pharaoh that hardens his heart. At least that seems to be the way it's used. He made his own heart stubborn. And then in verse 35, it literally just says that his heart was made strong. He didn't let the children of Israel go. So in this case, it doesn't explicitly say that it's Yod Heh Vav Heh. I can't argue with that. If the King James says that, then I doubt that it's a completely accurate translation in that case. We're going to later see that, it is going to be Yahuwah that is going to continue to make sure that his heart stays strong, because he's on a course that he's going to play out, whether he likes it or not. Okay. I still see the question on the scroll, the comment about how none of us ever have an answer for the difference in the frogs that are sent by Yahuwah and the ones that the magician sent. I guess part of the reason why I don't have an answer is because Scripture doesn't tell us. And, there may be people that'll give you an answer, but I ain't gonna believe it if it's not explicitly listed anyway. Because bottom line is, we don't know. Same thing is true for the blood, right? I would imagine that had the magicians the ability to do DNA testing, maybe they could see a difference in the blood or in the DNA of the frogs. Theirs are probably genetically modified frogs. Again, I'm not sure on any of that score, so my answer kind of remains, if Scripture doesn't tell us explicitly, then what we have is speculation. Every now and then there are some, dot connections that can be made, and I'm always willing to listen to a cogent case. But in this case, I just plain don't see any indications of how you could make a case on that score. So, I see the repetition of the question, and if anything, you'd figure that the magician's frogs were probably more localized. and I'll talk about this tomorrow some, because I've already got the article set aside. If you read the Midrash and see some of the things that people like Rashi talk about the frogs, there is a whole lot of rabbinic or oral tradition that appears with the frogs, saying that people were smashing the frogs, and when the frogs got smashed, they multiplied all the more, and so forth and so on. Well, again, that may or may not be true, may or may not be the oral tradition, but it's not explicitly said in Scripture. So again, can't draw conclusions from there. But I do think it's interesting and kind of funny, right, to talk about the frogs. So let me just make this a teaser for tomorrow. I'm going to spend a little bit more time probably talking about the frogs tomorrow, because I think there are some interesting parallels with the frogs that are being laid upon the world today, metaphorically at the very least. All right, well, let's do this. Well, let's pause at that point, and we'll have a little bit more music, and then we will talk about the frogs that inhabit the White House already and other places. What I want to do next is talk a little bit about the news this week, where we are on our own descent into tyranny and the kind of abject slavery that we're seeing play out all across the world. I guess if it's not obvious at this point, I think it's increasingly undeniable where we're headed. And we'll work up to the thing that I think everybody knows I'm going to head up to. But I want to start this way. Here's a story that came out of Norway. And there are similar stories literally all over the place out of Europe, where the Muslim invasion has, I guess you'd have to say, gotten to the point where it can no longer be denied even by the crooked European press. So here's a story that didn't get as much coverage from the mainstream press either place, but it's kind of hard to deny. In Oslo, Norway, the police are literally saying, quote, "We have lost the city." Another quote is that there's a local suburb. It's just a couple of subway stops from the parliament building in the capital of Norway there. And right next to a central station, it's called Groenland. And they're saying Groenland is now more Muslim than Morocco. It looks like all these basically Middle Eastern cesspools all rolled into one. People sell drugs openly. Police are essentially saying it's a done deal, stick a fork in it. And it's really, really ugly. in Germany, I think. Let me ask this question. It'll take a minute until we see the stuff appear on the screen. Give me some ones if you heard about the Rape Fest in Cologne, Germany on New Year's Eve. And it turns out it wasn't just limited to Cologne. It was all kinds of places, not just all over Germany, but all over Europe, and it's getting worse. Women in Sweden, in Norway, in Finland, in literally many, many places are being told, don't go out alone. The rapes have become an outright epidemic. So one, if you heard about the Rape Fest in Germany at the train station in Cologne, there were dozens of women that literally were subjected by this crowd of about 1,000 or so migrants to sexual abuse, groping, rapes, threats of murder, you name it. It was ugly. And, of course, lots and lots of robberies at the same time. So we have lost the city. Kind of might be a metaphor for what else is going on in so many places around the world. Here's a piece from Dr. Paul Craig Roberts. I'm not going to do the story right now, but the headline summarizes it. The rule of law, says this guy, who is a former assistant treasury secretary, cabinet-level position, no longer exists in Western civilization. The rule of law, he says, is dead in Western civilization. And he goes on to say this after making his point, providing a lot of evidence to back it up. The only thing we can conclude from all of these facts about what's going on in America today is that the United States government and those ignorant, and I'm quoting, fools who worship it are evil incarnate. Out of evil, he continues, comes dictatorship. The White House fool, he's talking about the jihadist in chief, obviously, at best a two-bit punk, has decided he doesn't like the Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution any more than he likes any of the other constitutional protections that once applied. He's looking for dictatorial methods, that is, unlegislated executive orders to overturn the Second Amendment, and of course, the Department of Justice, his criminal organization, is looking for ways to literally turn the dictator to a place where he can overrule congressional legislation, Supreme Court rulings, and let's not even worry about the genuine print that once talked about rights that shall not be infringed. This one. Now, this is another kind of a, let's just hit a couple of things all over the place to start with today. The economic meltdown continues. The Dow was down as of earlier this morning, in the first 4 days of the year, since the highs at the end of last year, the Dow was down over 1,200 points. It ended up down again. It has averaged close to 300 points a day all week long. This in spite of major interventions, no doubt by the plunge protection team. Certainly China is the one that has really led the carnage, and China is openly manipulating their markets, and they're failing. So essentially what you're seeing is the economic meltdown is well, getting hard to deny. I have said for a long time that you want to time the situation, you want to see where things are, watch World War III, watch the economic meltdown, and expect that all of the disarmament of American people, the fascistic dictatorship that is so clearly in plan, will happen at almost simultaneously with it. So we're there. Now, here was another interesting one, just, you know, connecting some dots. Probably a lot of you heard about the situation with Yemen, where in Yemen the Iranian embassy was bombed. Saudi Arabia and Yemen and Iran, they were talking about it being a proxy war before, but now it's almost forget the proxy. Just go ahead and do it. There was a... On a different front from World War III, there was an H-bomb test. Basically, seismically, it was detected earlier this week by North Korea. And it was supposedly, again, a hydrogen bomb. So this was a fusion bomb. Should have had a huge yield. Some of the experts were saying, well, maybe the bomb was a dud. Did not have the yield that you might have expected from an H-bomb. But at least one expert has come out and said, no, not so fast. What you may have to consider is that they're working instead on a super EMP, an enhanced electromagnetic pulse weapon, which would, well, be exactly what you'd want to do if you wanted to destroy, let's say, a national power grid. So there's something to be at least aware of. In Los Angeles, governor finally got around to declaring an emergency, a national or state emergency, over something that has pretty well been kept out of the press, but it turns out people are getting sick all over the place. They're calling it a land version of the environmental disaster that unfolded in the Gulf of Mexico. It is the largest gas leak ever recorded, literally an underground volcanic eruption. One expert said it's so far and above and beyond anything that we've ever seen. With barely a peep from the media, a disaster is unfolding in slow motion. May take months to stop, leaving thousands of Californians suffering at a minimum nosebleeds and vomiting, according to various stories. At least one L.A. doctor said, get out of that entire area. It's a few miles from Los Angeles. And it's attributed to Southern California Gas Company. They've been essentially trying to deny the impact to victims and so forth. It sounds a lot like, in other words, a kind of a natural gas, or in this case it's methane version of Fukushima underground. Or the BP. The Gulf thing, of course, within the Gulf. This is called BP on land, essentially. In Oregon, people probably heard about, this one's tough. Some fairly good guys that may have been duped. And there's more and more reports coming out and saying they probably have some agent provocateurs. They were probably put up to this and duped, but now they're stuck. They're caught between a rock and a hard place. They have occupied a, what's the name of this place? Oh, I'm looking for the name of the, I can't think of it. Anyway, it's a wilderness area, a little piece of land inside this wilderness area. And, sadly, what is likely to happen increasingly is that Big Brother will use this as an excuse to do exactly what they want to do. In other words, it looks like these folks, whether they are truly militia types or dupes or whatever, are playing into the Obama regime's hands by giving them exactly the excuse that they were looking for. How convenient to kill a bunch of people and say, see, when the little peons get out of line, you smash them like a bug. What I thought was interesting was the claim. It's almost fascinating to consider it. You had those two fellows, the Hammonds, father and son, that were sentenced to 5 years in the federal pen, minimum sentence, for what the feds claimed was arson. Now, what they were actually doing was a couple of separate fires set years and years ago, one of which was about brush control and noxious weeds, and it got out of hand. And did, according to the judge, as much as a whole $100 worth of damage to BLM lands that they were already paying the leases for anyway. In other words, not a big deal unless you're looking to hang somebody, and that seems to be exactly what they wanted to do. In the other case, they set a backfire that was intended to protect their property, and it, in fact, saved the ranch and a lot of their fencing and so forth. When the sentence was handed down, because the two guys said, yeah, we set the fires. You guys were setting fires on the same days, too. And in the case of the backfire that we set, it's because there were fires breaking out all over the place. Land was parched, and there were lightning storms, and we had fires here, fires there, fires everywhere. So they went to jail. The judge said 5 years is ridiculous. I'm not going to sentence them to 5 years. They went to jail. They served their time. Once they got out, the feds said, Achtung, we will have none of this. We want them to go back. So they've agreed to go back. Now, here's the funny part, right? These guys were convicted of arson because they dared to set a fire to protect their property, which may have gotten out of control. Yeah, happens all the time. As a matter of fact, it happened to the BLM a whole bunch of times and killed all kinds of farmers' cattle all over the very same area. Guess how many times the BLM said, we're very sorry, we're going to reimburse you for the dead cows and the destroyed fences. You know the answer, right? Oh, it's not arson when we do it. If we set an explosion in a mine in Colorado, and by negligence and criminal stupidity, we contaminate the entire Animas River and poison three states, why, that's not a problem. No one even loses their job or a day's pay on that score. But you two guys, you go to jail, and even after you've served your time, you're going to go back to jail. You can see how come people are upset about this, in other words. So I just want to point out some interesting things about this that kind of help put all this in perspective. It turns out that under the Bundy Ranch in Nevada, and also evidently under the Hammond Ranch up in Oregon, is a lot of uranium that the Chinese, among others, would like to have. And they, of course, are holding the U.S. debt. And it turns out, too, that the, according to at least one story, the uranium might be connected with the Madam Clinton regime. They're getting money from folks to push some of this stuff. We know that Dirty Harry Reid in Nevada was evidently part and parcel of trying to get rid of the Bundy Ranch. So it seems the real crime here, I'm going to just connect some dots, has nothing to do with arson, has to do with a couple of ranchers that got uppity and that didn't, like all their neighbors, decide to sell. Give me the deed to your ranch or I'll blow you all to bits. They didn't do it. And they are now paying the price, and they know it. Now, I got to ask you one more question. Remember the big MERS debacle? The mortgage electronic registration scheme and the robo-signing thing that was called MortgageGate. Tens of thousands, maybe more, literally millions of homes subjected to this abomination. How many banksters went to jail for taking, stealing, literally, hundreds, no, thousands, maybe tens or hundreds of thousands of houses, ruining lives? There have been suicides attributed to people that lost their homes, stolen. How many of them went to jail? Answer, you can count them on the fingers of no hands. But you got a rancher that dares to say, I don't want to sell? You, bucko, are going to jail. And just wait, folks. That takes us to the place where we're heading to, of course, and that is, you peons, you aren't going to be allowed to have guns either. And this week, I think, by the way, questions, comments on the screens, people are certainly welcome to ask. This week, we saw what I would say was probably one of the most significant proof cases to show that the United States is no longer a constitutional republic, hasn't been for quite some time, no longer has a rule of law, has nothing except a dictator that honestly, and I'm going to say this, I realize hyperbole is a problem nowadays, makes Adolf Hitler look reasonably tame by comparison. What? Did he really say that? Let me just suggest this. Last week on Shabbat, the question was asked, hey, how about Vladimir Putin, right? Here's a guy in Russia that seems, at least when you compare him to Obama, as scumbaggy as he may be, right? He's got a KGB, NKVD background, probably killed more than a few people. He is a power craving dude, knows how to get things done, and if necessary, by killing people in the process. And yet, people look at Putin and they say, well, you got to admit one thing, he looks good compared to Barry Sotero. And now I'm saying, oh, wait. You see, if you understand Adolf Hitler's game plan, if you see what the Nazis did, if you understand the sporting purposes test, in other words, if you go back and read the real history of the rise of the Third Reich and how it was that it was so important that they disarmed the peons, first in Germany, of course, and then in Poland and in Czechoslovakia and in France and all those places where they took over, it was a death penalty for one of the subject peoples to be caught with a firearm. And literally, you follow the history and you ask yourself the question, if you wanted to do it again, could you find a better game plan? And the answer is no. What Washington is doing, both parties, mind you, is playing out the Hitlerian regime, only this time they're learning the mistakes that Hitler made and doing it better. And still worse, folks, all of the pieces fit together. And I'm going to say something else. We're going to talk just for a second about the specifics of the regime's most outrageous, almighty pen-wielding yet. Obama's executive order, gun control. Now, the main thing was he said the following. You peons cannot be allowed to own property. Now, you've heard me talk about this before because these moves have been telegraphed literally for years. Matter of fact, prophecy, the mark of the beast, Revelation 13 talks about that there'll come a time when this evil person, the beast, will require a mark, a permission, call it a license, in order to buy or sell, that no one, rich or poor, free or bond, might be allowed to buy or sell anything without permission. Now ask yourself a question. This is something I've been pointing out for at least, probably over a year at this point. There's only one, count it, exactly one kind of property that is explicitly enumerated in the Constitution or Bill of Rights that shall not be infringed. It is specifically arms. Now, note the word arms there does not mean just firearms, in other words, just guns or rocket-propelled grenades or anything of the sort. By the way, Thomas Jefferson had a cannon at Monticello, actually more than one. So the idea that, oh, it's not military weapons is bull. That's as politely as I can put it. The founders were very clear on that. The idea is that the people are supposed to have delegated powers and authority to the central government. In other words, the central government doesn't have any power and authority other than what is given to them by the people. So if they can have nukes, why, no, don't kid yourselves, so can the people. In other words, the authority of the central government derives from the people. There is nothing that it can be allowed to do that the people don't have a pre-existing right to do. So in other words, they would have considered it flatulence to suggest that the right to keep and bear arms would not be limited at all to anything that any soldier in the U.S. Army or any other constitutionally allowed thing like the Navy could have. And here we've gotten to the exact opposite of that. So, point again, if you wanted to say, how do you get a mark of the beast in place? Well, let's start with the one kind of property that is explicitly protected by the Constitution, shall not be infringed. If you can infringe the living hell out of that, if you can tell people, Achtung, you will not have it, you must declare it, you must have our permission to buy or sell it. Hell, we got to the point now, folks, where a granddad, according to the imperial pen, can't even give a .22 rifle to his grandson without an FFL. Well, that is if both grandfather and grandson are slaves of the almighty state anyway. They gotta have Big Brother's permission. How's that for your right to property? Well, think about it. If you can't go through an airport with a gun, and if they're going to grope your gonads as a prerequisite to your so-called right to travel, what would you have expected? If you were looking to put a mark of the beast in place, how could you have done any better of a job than to say, ha-ha, look at this, we're going to make you guys have permission to buy and sell the one thing the Constitution says shall not be infringed? How obscene is this? Now here's the other funny story goes along with it. Then we'll get back to the latest usurpation of what's left. Literally, we're done. There is no Bill of Rights, period, anymore. But this came out of the UK's Daily Mail. And it's talking about the fact that, well, there's another element to the mark of the beast as well. It's been going for 10 years. It's called the Real ID Mark Act. I put the word mark in there. They just call it the Real ID. It's the mark. It was passed 10 years ago, and it says that, Achtung, you will have government-approved ID with biometrics now, of course, in order to travel. And furthermore, since the Congress, you know, the so-called Republican Congress that just gave Obama and the imperial regime everything they asked for and more, just said to the IRS, you have the right, no peons can travel without your permission, to take away people's passports. Put them on a list, take away their passports. Put them on a list, they can't fly. Put them on a list, they can't buy guns. Put them on a list and they won't be able to go anywhere, anytime. Take away their mark and they won't be able to buy or sell or eat or drink. And what this story from the Daily Mail says is this, this Real ID Act basically has 22 states that have complied with the so-called law, and the majority of states haven't. A lot of states are just telling Big Brother, go pound salt. But five of them, Illinois, Minnesota, Missouri, New Mexico, and Washington, have been deemed non-compliant. And so as a result, the peons that live in those five states are going to be told they can't even fly unless they have a passport. And if Big Brother takes away their passport, they can't travel at all. And guess what? We're not going to just only do this at airports, as you know. We're going to talk about train stations and bus stations next. Can you see how it, well, you know the line from the A team, right? I love it when a plan comes together. No passport, no flight, no Big Brother's approval, no Obamacare, no passport, no flight, no travel, no gun for you, and what are you gonna do? Hey, just like exactly the same choice that any jihadi gives any conquered territory. Worship Allah, pay the jizra tax, or die. And we're not done with the most recent outrages from the executive order. Not only is it just plain absolutely like a superhighway to the mark of the beast, you can also be denied a gun if you're on any kind of a list. How about if you're on Social Security and have automatic deposit? Well, you might be deemed incapable of handling your own finances. That's one of them. We've already seen any number of veterans that are being told, you might have PTSD. You might have some stress from the things that you went through while you thought you were defending your country and ha-ha, you thought you were defending your God-given rights. Well, here's your reward. No guns for you. No speech for you. No nothing for you, you peon. We've seen lots of veterans denied what they thought they were fighting for, their right to keep and bear arms. And people on Social Security and others are now being told, you too can be denied a gun. Put you on a list, we'll deny you a gun. Oh, guess what? If we can change the meaning of words and define commerce and define who has to have a federal firearms license and all of this kind of stuff, why, can't we just add more and more people to lists for more and more reasons? The latest one, too, is doctor-client privilege. Doctor-patient privilege is a thing of the past. The Obama almighty pen has said, no, you know, forget that HIPAA law. Yeah, if a doctor thinks or is scared into believing that, well, he heard you're talking about going hunting. He heard you're talking about buying a gun. You are probably, therefore, he's going to rat you out and tell you that you can't have a gun either. So there's all kinds of other excuses. Americans critical of government, finally, can lose their rights. Say any number of stories. You could be diagnosed by an Obamacare physician as having oppositional defiant disorder. Why? Because you don't like what Big Brother is doing to what you thought were your God-given rights. And here's the easy one. This is, myself and at least 1,000 other people have pointed out, hey, look, anybody that can read can see that if the regime can say, if we declare, if I define you to be crazy, you can't have a gun. So how about this? If you want to have a gun, you must, by definition, be crazy. So no guns for you. And, of course, in the Soviet Union, if you didn't want to be a party member, that, by definition, too, meant you were crazy, because anybody that was sane knew where the bread was buttered, and they'd say, of course I want to be a party member. I don't want to die, do I? And if you said no, you must be crazy. So here we are. This is just basically sick, folks, in about every sense that you can think of. Where we are is a place where the rule of law, and here Paul Craig Roberts is right, the rule of law is dead in the United States. And this week, it became undeniable. Now, the other funny part of this, of course, is, can you imagine, remember how Tricky Dick Nixon? Tricky Dick basically did a trivial little thing. What did he do? Sent some crooks into the Watergate building to break down, you know, break into some file cabinets and steal some stuff. Well, what a peon! Look, NSA doesn't have to do that anymore. They listen, they monitor, they tap. Who needs to break into the Watergate building? You got an administration that basically looks at Tricky Dick's crimes and misdemeanors and says, you're a piker, man. We steal more stuff in a day than you dreamt of in your whole career. And you were a putz too, because you, when you got caught, resigned. See, now the lesson is, you tough it out. You double down. You say, you don't like it? I'll hurt you in a way that you'll never be able to prove. And that's exactly where we are. So the very fact that this has now gone on, it's been telegraphed for months, and here we go at the end of the week, and the so-called opposition party in Congress has rolled over, but like a bunch of cheap whores, and not even so much as said, hey, the right answer would have been, if you dare to rape the Bill of Rights anymore, of course we're getting used to it, but if you dare to do what you're threatening to do, we'll have you impeached and convicted of treason before the sun sets. That's what they should have said. Not a peep. Not a peep out of these eunuchs in the Congress. And that tells you all you need to know. Again, I go back and I look at Adolf and I say, you know, you got to give these guys credit for one thing. They've learned the lessons of history's worst dictators, and they've improved upon all of the techniques. So I see the comments on the screen. Yeah, you know, it's been dead for years. Stick a fork in it and so forth. And that is all true. Again, you know, those of us that have been praying and coming out of and trying to understand what has been going on, studying the Word, studying the fake gods of modern Mitzrayim in Washington, Sodom on the Potomac. This is not a surprise. But this is the week where even among the generally dumb public, at least those that have even a semblance of eyes to see and ears to hear, are having to say, okay, if we are paying attention to history, if we understand the clear lessons of history, I'm not rotten to steal your guns, and you can keep your doctor too. Their lips are moving, they're lying, but it's worse than that. This ends in one place, always has. You start with disarmament, you can steal people's property with impunity, and they've already proven that that's exactly what has been going on for years. And the next step is genocide. It's a very clear time. Well, you know, each week when we talk about some difficult things on the news, I always point out the men of Issachar knew the times and the seasons. We're told too. Yahushua told us, know the times and the seasons. It has been a consistent theme throughout Scripture. Choose this day whom you will serve. Joshua 24:15. He gave us his answer. As for me and my house, we will serve Yahuwah. All of those things are true. Arguably, it's never been more true, perhaps in all of history, than it is now. Know the times and the seasons. It's pretty obvious where we are. What needs to be done? Well, I think that's clear too. Touch not the unclean thing. Be separate. Come out of her. If you submit to a satanic fake god, oh, just wait and see what's going to happen. What we need to recognize is the lesson from Exodus. Ani Yahuwah. There is only one God. He doesn't live in Washington, D.C. If you're looking for a cretin from either party to come forward and say, I can wield the almighty pen better, you're fired! There literally hasn't been one of these imposters to the throne that has come out and said, I understand what the words shall not mean. And guess what? They even apply to me. To me? Are you talking to me? You think that would apply to me? No, I will wield the almighty pen better. Bull. We're past all of that. Those of us that know had better make sure we understand who we serve, because time draws short.